This is The Conversation. It's episode 173 with Jennifer Dalton. She's a Brooklyn-based artist, and she's the co-founder of Auxiliary Projects, which is an artist-run project space also in Brooklyn. Jen was also featured in Sarah Thornton's 33 Artists in 3 Acts, alongside a prior guest, William Pohaida. Sarah Thornton is also a prior guest, so you may know her from any one of those contexts as well. And she was so great to talk to, as you will hear. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where I highly recommend you go check out images of Jen's work, especially if you are not familiar with it. You can also see an awesome shot of her studio with the a little incredibly shrinking artist in the bottom left. So go check all those out at the website, conversationpod.com. I don't think there was anything that we didn't talk about for an artist podcast for this particular exchange. Not only, she lives in Williamsburg, we should say that from the start. So not only did we talk extensively about gentrification, and yes, that's a good portion of the beginning, but we also talked about elitism in the art world and beyond, the confidence of women compared with men in studio visits, all the way to who pays on the first date and why. And as a special bonus, we talked about the P word quite a bit. You get to hear me rant about the P word and Jen give her eloquent response, and we kind of, I guess, come to a sort of a mutual agreement. For those of you who are new to the show, the P word is, you will find out what that is. It's a word I prefer guests not say, and because Jen did not say it through, you know, almost an hour and a half of talking, I said, all right, let's have an exchange about that word since you like it, Jen, and we did. So yes, we do that. Jen has a show coming up. We'll talk about that in LA. We'll talk about that at the end. In the meantime, I think that's about it. Oh, one other thing about gentrification is I ran into the artist Carl Handel, who is an alum of this show, and at his opening, and he told me that he, who has been in Boyle Heights, which has been a lightning rod of gentrification, is actually, he bought a building in a neighborhood called El Sereno, which is about 10 minutes east of downtown, and he has displaced a couple of businesses there, or he is in the process of. So I just thought it was interesting, in light of this ongoing conversation about gentrification and artists, that in some cases artists are literally displacing other people, not just sort of over a long haul by moving into affordable neighborhoods and then them transforming. So anyway, it's something to think about in the back of your head as Jen and I are talking. Please stay tuned for the back end for more. And thank you very much for being here. I hope you enjoy this. It's a long one. Enjoy. Well, you're in Williamsburg. I don't even have to ask you, because not only do I know that, I think from our earlier conversation, but how many times have you been published in the Times as a Williamsburg resident?
Oh, that's I don't know, but not
a few times.
A small handful.
Right.
One time, actually, I don't even think that, I think there was like a sort of exception, but one time just in the last year, I feel like when Bill and I did the month-to-month project, and the New York Times called us quote-unquote younger Brooklyn artists, and I think they were just talking about, they had previously been talking about, a sort of elderly-ish artist, but
right.
I was so thrilled to be called a younger Brooklyn artist.
Yeah,
but
that's
I
great.
Don't think that was Williamsburg in that case.
Oh, okay, got it. What part of, for the New York listeners at least, what part of Williamsburg? Are you in the north side or the south side?
Actually, the east side, the Graham area.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's three stops in?
Yeah, the Graham Avenue is the third stop. We're actually kind of between the third and the fourth, between Graham and Grand.
And which one is the, how many more stops is it to Bushwick?
Well, Bushwick is loosely defined, but two or three.
Okay.
I guess, to the beginning of Bushwick. Like, Bushwick and East Williamsburg are kind of overlapping.
Right.
Depends on what the real, which neighborhood is hotter in terms of real estate.
Right. Right.
Which gets claimed there.
Well, the way that I orient myself just from my own time in Williamsburg is that, you know, it was the north side and the south side, basically, because I was on the north side. And, mm-hmm. You sort of had more development going on and more artists going on the north side, and the south side, you sort of headed towards the Jewish neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And now, I guess, you could probably orient it a number of different ways, but it seems, and clarify for me, but it seems that the closer you get to the water, the more you have those over-the-top developments with, you know, ridiculous price tags. Is that sort of in the ballpark?
Yeah, generally speaking, yeah. I mean, the big rezoning that was done mm-hmm. that enabled those really big luxury towers was in 2004, and that was just the waterfront, the first one.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's what's been, like, most built up, but I don't know how much you get back, but there's now, like, big apartment buildings, like, tall and, like, big developments. They've rezoned the so-called inland areas also, so now they're scattered all around, but there's not the same concentration.
Mm-hmm.
The waterfront's the main, still the biggest concentration of that.
Well, how long have you been in your current place, and how much change have you seen there?
Well, I've been in Williamsburg for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I lived on the north side in the mid to late 90s, and then in 2003 we bought this house over in the other, we called it moving off campus. So we've been in this with campus moves though, but
right.
We've been in this house since 2003.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's a little row house and in this sort of quieter residential
mm-hmm.
section
mm-hmm.
over here.
And we is you and your partner?
My husband.
Uh-huh.
And now we have a 12-year-old son also.
Right. Is your son involved in art in any way?
He is not involved in art at all, and in fact doesn't really like it very much. I think there's a little bit of just like enjoying. There's some glee for him in not liking it. I don't know how much he really did. Like, if he didn't have a mom or a parent who was an artist,
right.
I don't know that he'd define himself as not liking art, but it's
right.
fun for him to do that since he does. But he really takes strongly after my husband, who is a computer guy, and my son is really into math and science.
Got it, right.
And they are out of my depth.
Right.
The time when they're
so your son got more of your husband's sort of DNA.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So do they gang up against you, like mom, that crazy artist kind of thing?
No, more like I can tell Oliver, my son, is going to ask me a question, and then his mouth closes and he goes, "Never mind, I'm going to have to wait and ask Dad." And it'll be like, you know, how much bigger is our moon than the moon of Jupiter or whatever.
Right, right.
And I'm like, they just have their own thing. And I have my own thing, but I do it by myself.
Was that ever heartbreaking at any point, or was it just kind of like, oh, whatever? Did he try to ask you a question and you didn't know the answer? And he said, never mind.
No, I can, it's better than him asking it. I've learned.
Right.
Although we can always ask the internet, which I can do.
Right.
But, I thought you were asking if it was heartbreaking that he wasn't an artist.
No, no, no.
And heartbreaking is too strong, but I think there's like a tiny bit of disappointment that, you know, that he doesn't, you know, because it's fun to share that kind of interest and,
yeah.
Maybe someday he'll share it,
right.
But not now.
Right. Maybe when he's done rebelling over the next 10 years and he'll come around
yeah.
to it. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right. But getting back to where you are, so it sounds like you've got a pretty nice situation. And meanwhile, you've seen over these, 13, 14 years, just a ridiculous amount of development. And, you know, what has that been like? I mean, to what extent do you feel a sense of, I don't know, I don't want to put words in your mouth. So what do you feel over the years, you know, seeing your artist colleagues mostly go and not come, presumably.
Right. Well, right. It's a awkward and difficult situation where I feel very privileged to be able to stay, and I do have a good situation, and but the the surroundings are less and less, you know, what I signed up for.
Right.
And I've watched a lot of people, and a lot of people are struggling to stay. A lot of people are not able to stay.
Yeah.
And that is awful. Like, that is, it is horrible for them, and it's a loss for the community.
Yeah. And anecdotally, off the top of your head, of the people that sort of come to mind, what sort of would you, how would you say it breaks down as far as people moving out to Bushwick, people moving out to, I don't know, Far Rockaway is a neighborhood I heard, or just leaving the city altogether as far as artists?
I was thinking at first about leaving the city, that you were asking about leaving the city altogether, which I think, I mean, it seems like there's quite a lot of that, like leaving the city altogether. Because, I mean, Williamsburg is insanely expensive, but the whole city is pretty, the whole city is more and more unaffordable.
Yeah.
But in terms of leaving Williamsburg, I feel like a lot of people go to Queens or deeper into Brooklyn. I mean, I feel like Bushwick is almost as expensive as Williamsburg right now. So nobody's leaving. Well, I shouldn't say nobody, but it's not like an easy move from Williamsburg to Bushwick
right
now either.
Yeah.
So people are really going farther. I don't know anyone. Well, I can think of one person. But in general, I don't think there's a big exodus to the Rockaways. But maybe there are in some circles. I know, because, there's art stuff going on there. But... yeah, or even like L.A. I feel like L.A. has got a lot of our good people. Like, people are moving, farther away also when New York is not habitable anymore.
Right, yeah. And I assume that has happened slowly, so it's not kind of like you wake up one day and everybody's gone. It's more like, you just kind of get used to the migration out. The exodus.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's what it seems like to me. It's not like a big wave, but just like a slow trickle.
Right.
Yeah. And actually, the more I think about it, we've lost a bunch of friends to Seattle as well. So there's a West Coast pull, I think.
Interesting, huh? And Seattle is also not exactly an affordable city at this point.
Yeah. I guess the people that that I know who've moved to Seattle, it was several years back, but I don't know Seattle very well.
Right. Well, all this kind of brings up to what extent, you feel obligated to fight for artists' rights. And, I will not hide the fact that, that you came into my consciousness when I read you quoted in this December Times article called Artists and Their Muse, Gentrification, which you were quoted in relation to your month-to-month piece or series of events. And you said, among other things, you said, we being artists are used by marketing people and developers as a sign that a neighborhood is going to be palatable for wealthier people. And you say, we are part of the process, but also pawns. So, I'm just trying to figure a way into a question around, you don't have to do anything. You've got a place, you're there, you're not going anywhere. But where does the fire come from to, be an activist, to try to somehow make, however modest, an impact on the changes, the gentrification, and so on?
I don't know, except I would say that there's an artistic part of it where I guess anything that I do, not anything I do, but I mean, I am an artist, so sometimes art, things get expressed that I do in art. That's one way that I can express things. But also I feel like it's more just as a citizen, just feeling unfairness.
Mm-hmm.
Like it feels what's happening is unfair. I mean, there's like fraud involved, you know, some of the time, and it feels, and the greed is depressing and enraging. And you know, and artists don't have the worst of it, because generally, overall, you know, we are, we have more resources. Even if you don't have money, you have more resources. Like,
mm-hmm.
Generally, as a class, there are more artists are come from more educated backgrounds, et cetera. But I guess it's just a sense of unfairness and wanting, even if we can't change it, to expose it feels important.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And tell me about the project. I mean, do you feel the month-to-month project, can you give us just a sort of a brief encapsulation of what it is, and it's still going on now, or did it finish?
It finished. It was 1 month. It was in May, May 2016, and it was a series of events, and also it was an experiment in like sort of a housing swap situation, where we held a lottery for people to stay for free in apartments over the course of the month, and those are the apartments where we did the events. So the events were public, but they were held in private apartments, and we had every weekend we were in one quote-unquote luxury apartment and then one quote-unquote affordable apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And then we held events in those two spaces that were, like, you know, suited to the apartment that we were in, and they were open to the public, and we served like food, and sometimes they were dinners and alcohol, and we had a guest living in the apartment for the weekend as well, who was a sort of fish out of water, but also like was also sort of serving as the host, like the sort of guest host,
right,
in for these events, and then they sort of provided this additional perspective of living in a neighborhood that they're not used to living in, and reflecting on, you know, what it means, like how you are defined by the neighborhood that you're in. So there was, you know, in our housing lottery, mimicked the lottery for like the New York City affordable housing lottery,
mm-hmm.
Where you fill out a very complicated form and give a whole bunch of information. And then, you know, you basically have a 1 in about 50,000 maybe chance of getting one of these affordable apartments.
Right.
And so we wanted to mimic that process.
Right. How did you get a hold of these luxury apartments that you used?
We were sponsored by Month to Month. I'm sorry, we were Month to Month. We were sponsored by AmoreArt. AmoreArt produced the project. They're a social art organization, and they were able to get the apartments. I think the luxury apartments were all donated. They were able to get the luxury apartments donated through their networks. And then the affordable apartments were either donated. Actually, William Pajeda, my partner in the project, donated his own apartment for 1 weekend. His was one of the affordable apartments. And so the affordable apartments were either donated or, so we were in 2 different apartments every weekend. So that would be 8 apartments, although we were in one of the luxury apartments 2 weekends in a row. So we had 7 apartments. And of the 4 affordable apartments we were in, 2 of them were donated and 2 of them were, we rented on Airbnb, which is ironic because Airbnb is one of the, you know, one of the topics of discussion as not being entirely helpful for housing costs.
Yeah. Not entirely helpful is a pretty
plain
way of putting it, right?
Understatement.
Yeah. So were the fanciest places then Airbnbs, luxury apartments?
No. The fanciest places were Lent, and it was actually the affordable apartments. And affordable really has to be in quotes because these were really modest apartments, but they were not affordable. Like if you were trying to rent these apartments for a month, it was really quite expensive.
Right. You know, going back to these lotteries, because I've been doing a little bit of my own research around recent affordable housing that is made available to lottery type situations. There was one that was completed quite recently in Bushwick. I don't know if you're aware of it, but it's like a 2 or 3 story sort of loft style deal. It looks like. I don't know if that rings a bell, but I mean, we're talking about real affordable, you know, and mm-hmm. 2 and maybe even 3 bedroom type situations. And these are the kinds of things, like, as you said, that figure sounds, especially for New York, about right, 1 in 50,000. So that's typical for an affordable housing.
Right. I have no idea. I shouldn't say I have no idea, but I don't know what the odds are for, like, if you averaged out all of the lotteries,
right.
You know?
Right.
But it is, you know, it has been in the press in several situations, and I don't know about the Bushwick one, but it's like several building developments that have been in the press have said, for instance, there are like 50 units available in the affordable section, and they got 87,000 applications.
Wow, right.
So those are the kind of numbers that you hear. But that having been said, I know a couple of people who've gotten them.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do get them, it's an incredible situation. You really are living in a nice place. Even if you do have a poor door, you're living in a nice place for a really reasonable amount of money.
Yeah.
Well, it depends, actually. And we'll get into weeds here. I don't know how much you want to, but
sure.
You know, so affordable means different things, and
sure.
I'm sure it's different even in other cities, but the way that New York, you know, tax incentives worked under the former regime that's still being renegotiated to be extended, but
mm-hmm.
the way that it worked, like these developers would get the tax breaks independent of what slice of the income bracket they were aiming at, as long as it could go up to... Yeah, gosh, I don't have these numbers at the tip of my head anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But you can make like $150,000 a year and be eligible for some of these affordable apartments, like
right.
if they're like quote unquote middle income.
Right.
And so some apartments are targeted at people making up to, you know, like say whatever, 100 to 150. So, and then, of course, there's like the actual truly affordable apartments that can be aimed at people making, like if you make the lowest one, I feel like you can price out of the lowest ones if you make like $40,000 a year
mm-hmm.
or more.
Mm-hmm.
And these are vague numbers that I don't have at the tip of my fingers anymore like I used to, but it's something like that. But all of those are considered quote-unquote affordable apartments in terms of the developers getting the tax breaks.
Right. Yeah, and speaking of developers and tax breaks, another thing that I sort of noticed, and I imagine you can sort of address this to some extent, that when you do have a building with a number of affordable housing units in it, it's just a portion of the building. That seems to be the case in the New York area, right? And maybe elsewhere as well.
It's either a portion of the building or in some cases, like along the Williamsburg waterfront, like you were saying with all the built-up buildings.
Yeah.
Some of those built-up towers
mm-hmm.
have smaller, less attractive siblings
right.
next to them.
Right.
And those are the affordable housing.
One of the things that I was thinking about before we were going to talk is there's this meme or this sort of this notion in relation to the election in which people are going to, flee for Canada and that whole kind of thing. And instead, you know, the idea is, no, stay where you are and turn your red state purple, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking about that in terms of being a resident in a highly rapidly gentrifying area, you know, and if there's sort of an analogy to be made there. So like if you're in Williamsburg, rather than, I don't know, it kind of doesn't work actually, but the thinking in other words is that when you're in a neighborhood that's gentrifying rapidly and you want to, and which is kind of goes back to this quote, you know, that how we're the artists are the pawns, you know, in the process, you somehow stay there and you keep it from, or you change it in a positive way instead of letting it be taken over. Does that make any sense?
Right. Yeah, but I can see why. I mean, it is a sort of, that's a struggle to figure out how one does that. I don't know the answer to that, because I think a lot of the things that artists think of to do, mm-hmm. like I have a little artist-run gallery in Bushwick that I run with the artist Jennifer McCoy.
Mm-hmm.
And you can call that keeping it real, or you can call that just like keeping a neighborhood artsy so that more yuppies want to live in it.
Right, you know? Right. So on one hand, you're trying to be part of the solution, but in many people's eyes, you're part of the problem.
Right. Or not even in many people's eyes. You're sort of both simultaneously part of the solution
right.
and part of the problem.
Right. Well, I think a more cogent way of sort of more cogent point that I hope that I can make is just this idea of being like as you are, you know, in Williamsburg, which has changed so much, you know, in the last 10 years, and perhaps even more in the last five. You can be more specific about that than I, obviously. But the just this concept that you're in this place where everything is changing around you, and, you know, the place that you moved into is no longer the place that you moved into.
Right.
And just, you know, you and everybody else around the city that, you know, like perhaps even these people who are moving into, who are winning the lottery and getting these affordable apartments and are moving into these really nice neighborhoods, and they're surrounded by rich people, as it were. You know, that's what it feels like.
Right.
You know, what is that? Mm-hmm. You know, how is that for people?
It's really weird. I mean, I think that it feels like, I mean, less in our, like over here in our like sort of mostly lower density, you know, East Williamsburg.
Mm-hmm.
But when we are in the North Side, it always still, I mean, I just feel like I am an old person now, but like, I just feel like it's Manhattan. Like, I feel like, you know, it's what I moved out of, like what I was trying to get away from
yeah.
in the 90s, you know.
Right.
It's very Manhattan-y. It feels bridge and tunnel-y, or, you know, like, I remember, I told this story at class, actually, I mean, at class, at month to month, but, when I lived in Williamsburg in like 1996, my friends and I would sit around and say, I wish this neighborhood just had one nice bar.
Right.
And then I said that to, you know, when we were having one of our conversations at month to month, and someone asked me, how many times did you wish that?
Right. That's brilliant. Yeah.
But, you know, that's like the reality, one of the realities of gentrification is when people live in a neighborhood that is starting to get more amenities, you are, of course, happy to see the amenities, but you also know what they mean. Like, that mm-hmm. means this process is starting, you know, and that the process has, this is the beginning of the process, and you already feel like you can see the end of the process, and it might involve you not living there anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, and the amenities of Williamsburg in the late, mid to late 90s, you know, were the nice sort of humble, modest, affordable types of amenities. And now they're just probably like the crushing, overly priced restaurant type amenities.
Right. And boutiques and stuff. But like,
yeah.
you know, we didn't have, you know, we hardly had a functioning grocery store. You know, we didn't have basic things.
Sure.
Or, you know, we had very few basic things, like, you know, in in the like 95, 96 kind of range.
Yeah.
And so we were happy to get some of that. And we were happy to get the first couple nice bars
mm-hmm.
that had like comfortable places to sit instead of wood benches or whatever. But yeah, then it obviously, it poured.
Right. Yeah. And did, are you tired of hearing people say, be careful what you wish for, Jen, kind of thing?
Oh, yeah. Of course. I mean, it's true. It's true in everything.
Right, right. Yeah. So there you are, you know, the dust has settled and, you know. Yeah, I'm just, I'm not ready quite to leave this sort of angle because I'm just picturing, you know, John Doe and Jane Doe in their apartments and it's all, and the amenities are there, but it's like, who are these people? You know, and you use the word, the bridge and tunnel expression, which is interesting. Oh, this is the thing that I remembered I wanted to get to earlier. You said it's all like Manhattan. I had a conversation with, the writer Emily Colucci, who actually, when she was looking to move out of a shared situation, get her own place, she went to the East Village, you know, because like Brilliant was too expensive, you know? So actually, there's a whole flip with Manhattan and Brooklyn.
There is. I'm hearing that a lot, that that many parts of Manhattan are cheaper than Williamsburg is right now.
Yeah.
I feel like people are moving to the Upper East Side. Like the Upper East Side is weirdly reasonably priced these days.
Right. Yeah. So are you originally from California?
I am, yeah.
Where?
Well, I mostly grew up in San Jose.
Okay, Bay Area.
Right.
Bay Area. So you finished UCLA and then you went to New York, which is what I did. And you stayed. And I stayed for a while and then I left. And, you know, so to what extent, how long have you felt like a New Yorker? Do you still feel like a New Yorker? Do you feel like the California is out of you now? You know, all of that.
Well, I really love California, in particular LA. I really like it there a lot and I miss it. I stayed in LA 4 years after I finished at UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
And when I think of home, you know, like that feels like where I'd go back to. My parents are still in San Jose.
Mm-hmm.
But so I've been in New York since 94. And I do feel like a New Yorker, but I also miss LA. And I wish I could get there more, basically. But I did when I came to New York in 94, it was to go to grad school at Pratt.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came here, I thought that I was just going to go to grad school and then go right back. But, then I just never did.
Right. The momentum just never goes away, does it? It's hard to leave New York.
Yeah.
As hard as it is to get into
like
it.
Yeah. Like the gravitational pull.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
When did you move back?
Oh, we're not talking about dates on this podcast. We could talk about that off air. But
okay.
Yeah, but I was in New York for 12 years. So.
Okay.
It's really kind of simplistic and remedial in a way, but I couldn't kind of handle both the combination of the crush and the feeling like, not being a wealthy person in New York felt
right.
sort of disempowering. Have you felt like that at various points?
Yeah. I mean, it's just the culture there's like this pressure to overspend. Everyone's like living, either everyone, it seems sometimes, and it isn't, I think that it's because there's a lot of smoke and mirrors, but everyone is either wealthy or severely living outside their means, you know?
Yeah.
So there's like a pressure and a culture to sort of live larger than you should or can.
Right.
You know?
I think we alluded to this, correct me if I'm wrong, when we spoke last time briefly, but you totally made me think of this, which is speaking of smoke and mirrors, you know, the reality of how many artists are able to be artists, especially in a place like New York City, because there is some kind of underground, you know, oil situation. As in,
right?
They have some form of wealth that is you know, maintaining the foundation so that they can survive.
That's a funny metaphor.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, I think that in a place like this, in order to just exist, you know, it takes a lot of resources, and sometimes it's not obvious where they come from.
Yeah, right. Well, you're making me think of, you know, how you have supported yourself, you know, currently and in the past, and it was actually, I guess, made public and you're going to have to bring me and listeners up to speed on that, and just remind me too. In Sarah Thornton's 33 and a third artists in three acts.
Right.
So were you doing something related to auction houses, if I remember right?
Yeah, I worked at Christie's for a really long time.
Wow.
I worked at Christie's from when I moved to New York. Like, that was my part-time job in graduate school until like 4 or 5 years ago.
Now, when you got that job in grad school, was that, how did you get it? And was that kind of like, speaking of the lottery, was that like hitting the lottery or not necessarily?
You know, I got that job. This is totally, to talk about dating yourself. I mean, my age is open, but I got that job from a newspaper clipping, like a literal newspaper clipping.
Right. Village Voice?
What?
Village Voice?
Now I don't remember. No, I think it was the New York Times, though.
Okay. Uh-huh.
It was a really low-level job, and I kept the same low-level job for the whole time. Like, I never wanted to advance because it felt like it would, like, if I had real responsibilities, it would be too hard to do what, you know, my art and stuff. And they let me, you know, have flexible hours. I worked at home for a lot of the last few years I was there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they let me, I had a very flexible situation. And so, and I really valued that, and they were really good to me. And so I never advanced or anything.
And what were you doing?
It was an easy, I was doing like, appraisal. I was not doing appraisals. Like, I was never a specialist, but
right.
I would do like the, word processing. Like, I would do like the document production of the appraisals. So, like, the specialists would go and on the visits, and then they'd come back with all these notes or dictated tapes or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and then I would turn those into the appraisal, like, you know, formats and wording and stuff.
Right.
I would make the documents.
Right.
And it was at times a super interesting job. I mean, you know how things can be interesting and boring at the same time. Like,
right.
It's kind of monotonous, but also I got to see a lot of cool stuff. And then a few years ago, I got a job working for a collector. I now manage a private art collection.
Wow. Are you allowed to say who the collector is?
I think it's probably fine. I mean, actually, it's like public knowledge. I work for David Howe.
Okay.
And
I don't even know who that is.
He runs a gallery called 601 Art Space also in New York.
Okay.
And so that's where, like, I'm affiliated somewhat with 601 Art Space. Like, even though I manage the collection, and then there are other people running the gallery, but but that's where I work.
And was that thanks to your work at the auction house?
I think that experience, you know, because it's archiving kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
a lot of it. I think that experience made me, like, you know, gave me the qualifications. But I was recommended by my good friend Jennifer McCoy, the artist that I run my gallery with in Greenpoint, actually.
Mm-hmm.
The collector is a collector of her work, and she works with her husband, Jennifer and Kevin McCoy. She introduced me to him.
Wow. Okay. And so an ongoing conversation that has, I guess, particularly kind of become of interest of late for me and listeners is when you work for an artist or a gallery or a collector or what have you, they all seem to apply, you know, how is that? How does it affect the way you think about yourself as an artist? I mean, it sounds like with the auction house and even with this working for the collector job, both seem pretty low impact. But, you know, I don't want to put words in your mouth. So how has it been?
Well, this job working for the collector is like maybe the first job I've had that I really liked.
Oh, wow. That's
like,
fantastic.
I actually really like it.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting. He's really great. The group I work with is really great.
Mm-hmm.
That are affiliated with the gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoy like the collection. I really like the collection. You know, I've curated a show, or I guess curated and co-curated a couple shows at the gallery at 601 Art Space.
Mm-hmm.
And so this job has, I feel like, melded really well into the rest of my art life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes art jobs really don't, you know, but
yeah.
I think this one really does for me.
Right.
It works really well. It's a great situation, and I'm glad to have it.
Yeah. And just to go back to 601, the collector you work for owns the space. Is it a nonprofit? I mean, are the exhibitions contain works from his collection? How does all that work?
So it's not a formal nonprofit. It is not for profit. Like,
right.
Basically, it's a non-commercial space.
Got it.
The shows consist of, I think that increasingly they are less and less directly tied to the collection,
mm-hmm.
but the shows are like, sometimes they're often curated by outside curators, and they sometimes include some works from the collection and then also other works from outside the collection. I think that's probably over the last few years, the most common way that it's worked is that there's some collection works and some outside collection works, but we've also done some shows that had no work from the collection
mm-hmm.
at all, like if someone presented us with an interesting idea.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've had other shows that were completely from the collection.
Right. And as somebody who has done a decent amount of curating, speaking of the curating you've done for 601 and the gallery that you've been running, it occurs to me, I haven't done much conversation with artist curators, and it's something on my mind, and I would love to hear some thoughts of advice that you might have as an artist curator, just as far as what are some of the things maybe that come to mind as things that you think would be helpful. I mean, for one, I know that, and this conversation has come up before, it's always on my mind anyway, when it comes to curating, there are some people that are really easy to work with, and there are others that are maybe a little less easy to work with. And so to what extent do you organize your curating around that? Or is it more just, you know, you choose the work first and, you know, those kinds of situations evolve as they evolve?
Right. So artists who are easy to work with are hard to work with, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah. I think that being, I mean, easy to work with is maybe not exactly the way I'd put it, but I think being professional is kind of important. And I think sometimes people make it really hard to work with them. Like,
I think that's synonymous. I'm sorry to interrupt. I think that's synonymous. In other words, the more professional somebody is, the easier they are to work with.
Yeah, I agree. I think that is basically what I mean. I think you're right.
Right.
And sometimes, I mean, I never think about like, oh, we need someone who's easy to work with. But I think that sometimes you set out to work with someone and they make it nearly impossible. And then you're like, well, never mind.
That's exactly what I was getting at. Yes. Yes. Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or I imagine that you've had situations where there's an artist that you were probably really excited about including in a show idea that you had because you really were excited about the work and you thought it would make a great fit for your idea, and then you found out that X artist was a pain in your ass or they weren't interested.
Right. I mean, I think generally in my experience, it's less a pain in the ass and just sort of like hard to manage or something. Like, manage isn't even the right word. I'll have to like think about how I would characterize it.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think, yeah, professional is like a word that comes to mind, though. Just like they say they're going to do the thing and then they do the thing.
Right.
Like, I just think that basically doing the things that you say you're going to do,
mm-hmm.
just the age that I am now, that's just like a deal breaker.
Sure.
You say you're going to do the thing, you have to do the thing.
Right.
You know?
Well, and speaking of, and let me just take that opportunity to go back to New York, LA, you know, your two homes, as it were. What is your perception around doing the thing you say you're going to do in New York versus LA? And I'll preface why I asked that question, because one of the reasons that I've had, and I think I told you this before, I've had so many more New York-based guests is because in the referral process, the New York people have been much more reliable in their referrals, and those referrals have been much more reliable in becoming guests than in LA. And that's why I've had generally a dearth of LA-based guests on the show.
That is really interesting. I mean, I don't have enough experience. I don't have a big enough sample size. Like,
sure.
I just tend to work. The kind of work that I do centers a lot more around New York, and I don't have a really good sample size of LA to, like,
right.
to compare. But that is really interesting to me. I mean, but it's true. Like, if you reach out to someone, you know, from your position or as a curator or as an artist, a collaboration, if you reach out to someone and they do not, like, keep the ball rolling,
yeah.
then it doesn't happen.
That's right.
You can't.
There are a lot of balls stopped, you know, in their tracks.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
to go back to an earlier stem of this tree, or, you know, what have you, whatever metaphor you want to use, one of the things that I was driving towards when I brought up your work history, and also that reference to, you know, the people, the smoke and mirrors and the people who don't really need to work and that kind of thing, is the fact that you have worked, you continue to work. And the work, and all that to say that I think, and I'd like to hear, obviously, your take on it, but it seems that the work that you make, which is, for lack of a better word, conceptual, very project-oriented, and very content-slash-activist-oriented, I would say, or fairly, maybe that's activist is too strong a word, but all that to say that your work maybe is not as marketable as, you know, your pretty pictures, you know, which tend to be the ones that sustain a lot more artists' careers. And so,
right.
Yeah, go ahead. Hey guys, just wanted to break in for a quick moment and remind you that this is a listener supported show. This show depends on your financial donations to keep going. There are costs involved, not only the hosting of the show online, but also equipment. We're due for an equipment overhaul soon. So I have some good news, though, and that is, in addition to the ongoing platform with PayPal, which you can get on theconversationpod.com/support, we are now on Patreon, which is a becoming to be well-known project supportive site where you can pay on an ongoing basis as little as $1 a month, and you can get some rewards in return. So if you want to go support the show through Patreon, you can reach that page through the website, or just go to Patreon, patreon.com, and look for the Conversation Artist Podcast there, and you will find our various platforms for rewards, and I hope that's suitable for you. So go check it out. Thank you very much in advance for your support. Now let's get back to the conversation with Jen. Your work maybe is not as marketable as, you know, your pretty pictures, you know, which tend to be the ones that sustain a lot more artists' careers. And so,
right.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think, I mean, you're I basically agree, except I don't know very many artists who truly make a living from their work, no matter what they make.
Wow.
I just know, I mean, in terms of my circle, I can think of a couple.
Right. That's fascinating. You know
what?
Yeah,
I mean, I've gone through periods where I've made enough money from sales. I mean, I know I think of my work as pretty unsellable, but sometimes people actually buy it, which is bless them.
Right.
But
right.
I've gone through periods where, you know, where I would have been able to earn a living from art sales for some period of time. But I never gave up the job because it's just, you don't know that that will continue.
Mm-hmm.
And it generally doesn't
right.
in my experience. And
right.
then the experience of almost all my peers, with a couple exceptions, like you can have a really good run of mm-hmm. a year or two or three or five, but it's fickle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just, I mean, I think it is easier to sell, you know, two-dimensional work than installations, you know, or sculptures
sure.
or whatever.
Yeah.
But I don't, but it, none of it's a given, I don't think.
Sure.
It doesn't seem to me.
Yeah, I would never say it's a given. On the other hand, the reason I said that was fascinating is because it sounded like the circle of yours, your artist circle, your intellectual circle, is self-segregated, you know, in terms of sensibility in that, you know, in that way. Like that your circle is composed much more, or if not mainly, of less marketable work, you know, because, because it is, I mean, there are, and this is always tricky to quantify, but there are always a tremendous number of artists out there that are making a living from their work, you know, and they're the types of people who I'm sure you know as, you know, even if they're not in your circle or what have you, but, you know, that are just, it seems like once their career got launched, that it doesn't seem like there's going to be any end to it. And I don't know if I'm over exaggerating that, but there's certainly a proportion of the art world, you know, in which artists have those kinds of careers, and maybe I'm overstating how large that number is. But I, all that to say that when you said, you know, that I don't really know people like that in my circle, I think there are other circles that is made up mainly of people who do have those kinds of careers.
I think that, and I think this comes back to the smoke and mirrors, but my opinion is that the number of artists who dependably make a living from their art is actually a very small number.
Right.
Like we're talking about, you know, the one percenters kind of.
Right. Yeah.
And the more, I mean, certainly, I'm not saying, I mean, certainly some mid-career artists can make a living from their work, some.
Yeah.
But my experience has been the more, like, people whose careers I've admired, and then I get to know them, and I find out that they teach. I find out that their partner is a financial wizard. I find out that they, you know, that they live in their parents' house, you know, or, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
I find out
right.
that there's oil under their ground somehow,
right.
you know?
Right.
So, and actually the oil under the ground, I mean, it's like it can be a hidden job, you know,
but
my experience over the years has been like, I just so many times have just thought like, well, this person has it made, like, look how awesome they are. They're in this magazine. They're,
right.
They have all these shows, you know, and then I get to know them and I'm like, oh, you actually have to sustain yourself through some other financial way.
Yeah, right. Well, I think the 1% that you alluded to is this set of artists who have studios, right? You know, the studio artists, like, oh, you should go work at so-and-so's
yeah.
studio, right? And they
yeah,
have
totally.
Anywhere from, you know, maybe as few as two or three to, obviously, you know, when you're talking about Koons, you know, you're talking about 100+ people, but, you know, generally in the neighborhood of what, like, you know, 8 to 12 people, They're those people. And obviously that's a very small number. But then you have a lot of artists who are doing okay on their own, you know, and they maybe have a person who helps them out, like when they do installations, you know, or what have you. So, you know, it's obviously very hard to quantify, but just...
I think it's really interesting, though, this whole question, because I've had people tell me that I had to ditch my job if I wanted to be a real artist. And I actually philosophically feel that it's almost the opposite. That I feel like having the job makes me more free to make the work I want to make. I do not feel desperation about needing to sell. And I think it's also kind of a little bit of like, if you want something done, you ask a busy person. Like, I think of like working with artists who are juggling many things, you know, has been a positive experience for me. You know, in terms of collaborations or other types of working with people. Like, I feel like, I mean, you know, I have a little bit of like a I don't know how to put it. I want to almost say Puritan, but that's not quite right. But like, I just, work is good for you.
Yeah, because you can get complacent when, you know, you have... Well, I mean, here's an example. I spoke with a successful painter a few years back on the podcast, and she has a teaching gig, or at least at the time had a teaching gig, and she had a sabbatical for a semester, and it was almost like it was too much time, you know, of unstructured studio time. So... But here's something that when you say, I think I know the answer based on what you've just said, but I was curious if it was even a thought in your head at any point in time that you would depend on your husband's income and just be able to do your work.
Well, full disclosure, he makes more than I do. So I do feel like I'm getting benefits that, you know, there's some oil under my ground, but, you know, he's a computer guy, so he makes more than I do. And, you know, I imagine, you know, if we drastically cut back, you know, on many things, which would probably include my outside studio, then maybe we could just live on his income, maybe. But I really wouldn't want the stabilizing, both the sort of lifestyle and financial stabilization of the job are good for me. And we, you know, we would also, like, I wouldn't have the money to make the work I want to make or have a studio or whatever, like, without this income. So, no, I wouldn't. I think I especially wouldn't want to, you know, imagine, like, I'm imagining he made, like, buckets and buckets of money and I really didn't need my job. I still wouldn't really want it. I mean, maybe I would, you know, but there's also just a sense of, like, it's funny because it's kind of like my own internal, like, it would feel sexist for me to quit and, like, live off of his job. And then I'd feel like, and this is, like, I actually think this is one of those, like, insidious, I haven't thought this all the way through, but, like, you know, and then I have a kid, so then I'm like, what am I, like, I'm sort of a housewife artist? Like, I'd rather be a day job artist than a housewife artist.
Yeah, that's a lot to meditate on. Yeah, I'm particularly taken by when you use the word sexist. That's a pretty creative or clever use of the word sexist, that if you were to take advantage of your husband, you know, being the breadwinner. It seems kind of like...
Well, I think that my reaction, it's hard to parse it exactly, but my revulsion towards that possibility is because it feeds into a sexist narrative or something.
Well, here's a really fundamental question for you, which is, if I were having to face this, it would certainly be on my mind. If you go on a date, let's say if you go on a first date, just for argument's sake, because you're not presumably right now.
Probably not.
Who pays?
Oh, totally Dutch.
Right. Definitely. But there's a whole segment of the population, and I imagine even quite a bit of it in New York City, you know, where the woman presumes that the guy pays, right?
Yeah. And
even
the guy presumes
that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like we artists slash creative types slash whatever you call us, we live in this different universe in a sense.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's right. That's always kind of been true. We have like an alternative, I mean, you know, but to an extent. I mean, there's still lots of sexism in the art world. You know,
right.
We don't exist outside of the rest of the world, but we do have some different values.
Yeah. So where is your studio? I'm curious to talk about that for a moment.
I rent a studio space from my neighbor. So my studio is in my neighbor's place two doors down from where I live.
Is it in like the ground floor or the basement?
Yeah, it's the ground floor.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's not the whole ground floor. It's
right.
part of the ground floor.
Okay.
He's an artist. He actually built, he sort of renovated his house, and this was going to be his studio.
Mm-hmm.
And then he realized that he couldn't really work at home, so he rents me that space, and he rents a studio somewhere else.
Oh, interesting.
So
it's the ground floor, which is divided up into like a few different rooms, or...
Yeah. Uh-huh. But we live in these houses that we live in. There's like an alley behind the houses,
mm-hmm.
which is really nice. It's like this quiet, secluded alley. And so I can go out my back door and walk. Like I skip one house and then I go in his back door and my studio is right there.
That sounds pretty idyllic.
It is totally great.
It sounds
not,
like you live
it will
in.
It not last forever.
It sounds like you
really
live
great.
In Venice, California.
Yeah. It's like a similar, I mean, vaguely similar kind of alley situation. Yeah.
Well, part of the reason that I was intrigued to bring up the studio is because looking at your work, which I applaud you and our listeners for their patience because we haven't talked about it in about now we're going on an hour. Specifically, which is fine, but if you look at a lot of your work, it was easy for me to say to myself, "Oh, she could easily be a laptop artist," you know.
Right.
But I understand too, you know, the value of being able to, if nothing else, sort of lay things out, set up a, you know, a mock installation for a show, that kind of thing. Is it more tangible? Is it more of a visceral experience than one might think from looking at your heavily conceptual based work?
I feel like I do almost all my work these days, the last few years, like at a table,
mm-hmm.
but I do feel the need to be able to spread out and put things on the wall and see how, you know, like to have the feeling of being able to see what something's going to look like in an open space. But I think I probably will someday go post-studio. But I'll need a storage space, so I'm paying for that then.
Right. So it'll become your storage space, your studio at that point.
Yeah, maybe I'll just have to get a storage space.
Right.
I really treasure having a studio, and I don't want to go post studio, but we'll just see how, like, I don't know what the future is going to hold with this neighborhood and being able to rent a studio when my friend eventually wants the rest of his house. But,
mm-hmm.
Oh, I was going to say that, I think the likely way I would go next in the near term would be to share a studio. Cause that works really well for me. Cause
mm-hmm.
I just tend to, you know, you want to spread out, like if you need to try an idea out or if you have a studio visit, but the rest of the time I can be pretty compact.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you, with your gallery partner, Jennifer McCoy, is that her name?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What is the name of the gallery that you, the artist-run gallery you run?
It's Auxiliary Projects.
Okay. And that's in, was it Bushwick?
It's in Greenpoint,
actually. Greenpoint.
We were in Bushwick for a while, but mm-hmm. we moved to Greenpoint. We moved to the McCoy's garage, actually.
Oh, okay. Got it.
2 years ago.
Got it. And you actually...
So that it's affordable.
Right. Right. Because Greenpoint at the... Oh, right. Yeah, because it's their place.
Well, if they have a garage,
sure.
Then it's affordable.
Yeah. And you guys have been to Miami with the gallery?
We did. We went to Untitled. A couple years ago.
Okay. And so that all brings me to the piece that you did, Hello, I'm... which is the, as in the sticker, hello, I'm so-and-so.
Oh, yeah.
Is just a great entry point for talking about fairs, even if it's only for a moment. I had a guest on who works at a big gallery here in L.A. We talked about Miami, you know, and her experience there. And my sort of line is, just to get this out of the way, is as a preface to the piece that you made, is that, you know, I've been to the Armory and, you know, and a couple of other fairs, and I have never been to Miami. I have no interest in going to Miami. Somebody tried to convince me that I should go to Miami recently. You know, I said to this person, if I have a piece there, you know, or have some other kind of business, even if it's the podcast, you know, I'll go. But otherwise, I have no need to go. So you don't have to respond to that. I just wanted to give that as a preface. Because your Hello, I'm, which you had at Expo Chicago in 2015, do you want me to just, because I have them right in front of me, the descriptions, I'm just going to read them.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so you have different colors, bright colors, round stickers, and they're the kind of thing that you would put on your lapel or whatever, that, you know, Hello, I'm, and they say, not sure why I'm here, deeply uncomfortable, alternating between depressed and inspired, stealing your ideas, not impressed, feeling pretty good about this, in my element, hoping for the best, wearing the wrong shoes, and enjoying proximity to wealth. I think you covered the waterfront there with those. And so I guess I'll say that mine would probably be a combination of deeply uncomfortable and alternating between depressed and inspired. That would probably be me.
Yeah,
what would yours be?
Alternating between depressed and inspired. I mean, of course, you feel all of them sometimes, but
sure.
Alternating between depressed and inspired was really, that encapsulates it for me, because it is such a depressing situation, and you can walk around being so feeling alienated.
Yes.
And then you see something good,
mm-hmm.
and you're like, oh,
right.
You know, because there, of course, there's good work. There's all the work there. Like,
sure.
So, and it's not the best setting for seeing it, but you do see good stuff.
Yeah.
Like it's not like all the work is bad or anything.
Yeah.
It's just a hard situation to see it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well said. And to what extent were you able to get fairgoers to wear these stickers?
Well, I didn't get to go to Expo Chicago, but Charlie James, the gallery,
mm-hmm.
was putting the pictures of people wearing them on social media, and people were totally wearing them.
Nice.
It was very exciting for me to see that, it's like a physicalization of that idea that artists, of course, you want your art and your ideas to, like, to travel throughout,
yeah.
You know, you want them to be portable. You want people to take them with them in their heads, you know, and this felt like it literalized that, like people were spreading the ideas. Like it was sort of like a, I don't know, then I wanted to go to the disease metaphor, but that's not really the way, it's not in my ideal world.
Right.
But to see them see these little dots, wandering around the crowds made me very happy.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
And to just see how trashed the sticker dispensers got,
mm-hmm.
like people just mauled them, and that also made me happy. Like, I like it, you know, you're really just supposed to be so genteel around art, and it's fun to mess with that, to let people really get their paws all over things.
Was it ever on the table to take that to another fair?
It hasn't been yet, but I would love to. I mean, it feels like it's a pretty art fair specific piece.
Right.
You know, it was conceived with that setting in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so it would be I'm just trying to think of it, you know, how it would make sense in other places. But I
no,
would
I was thinking Miami.
Paris.
I was thinking Miami.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It would be awesome to have it at Miami.
Yeah.
If someone wants to take it to Miami.
Right. I don't know. So how many, in addition to taking your gallery to Untitled, what, how many fairs have you been to either as a gallerist or just artist or viewer?
Many fairs.
And what do you have any other takeaways other than what you already said about, you know, you can see some great stuff, but it's just a bad environment to see them in?
Well, it's a trade show, you know,
yeah.
Like it's a conference and it's a trade show.
Right.
So, you know, there's really, in the bad ways, of course, because it's all very commerce driven, but
mm-hmm.
then in the good ways where, like, you know, like I have friends in the academic world, and when they go to their conferences, you know, that's where they exchange ideas and bump into people that they only knew their work and are so excited to get to know. And, you know, so the bad word for that is networking, but also it's like a professional, exciting professionally to be bouncing around like all the people in your world that you don't normally get to talk to.
Yeah.
So there's right. good things about it also, but it's the commerce aspect of it can feel pretty crushing.
Sure.
Like either as an artist or and as a gallerist, I've only presented as a gallerist at fairs twice. The other time was actually at Spring Break last year in New York, which is a really different kind of alternative
sure.
situation. But
yeah.
So and also it was in New York, so it sort of. Was, well, it was in my hometown. It doesn't matter what town, but it was in my hometown. That made
right.
it sort of easier. But as when you're presenting, when your work is at a fair or when you're a gallerist, it's like, you know, you feel so much on this like knife's edge of like other people's opinions really mattering to you.
Yeah.
You know, like, so people are always like, how's it going? And that really only means one thing. They mean, are you selling? You know?
Yeah, right.
And it's like this constant, like measuring your, how do I measure up? Like this booth just sold three things and, you know, no, nobody's buying mine or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, it took I'm sorry. I was just going to say, it took me a while to realize when I asked people when they, particularly gallerists, when they came back from Miami, when I said, how was Miami? That I wasn't just asking how it was. I was probably asking how it went, you know? And
right,
so
right.
they have to basically lie. They have to say, oh, it's great, you know? And then they can go on about, you know, how it was slower this year or it was crazy or whatever, you know? But basically they have to say it was great.
Right. I had a friend of mine who's a journalist tell me the most illuminating thing
mm-hmm.
a while back. So she covers the fair. She's been, like, going for years. And she said that the same thing happens every year. Every year. Like, so here's year one. She goes around the booth, and she's like, so how's it going? And they say, oh, it's going great. Oh, it's everyone, you know, we're getting great response. It's really, we're doing very well. And then the next year she comes around, and the same galleries say, oh, this year is going really great. Last year was a shit show.
Right. Right. That's awesome.
And that happens over and over and over again. Like they can admit
yeah.
a year later
right.
that it didn't go well.
Right.
But they had to spin it in the moment.
Well, what have you been hearing about this Miami, for example? Because this was a December after the elections. Was it immune to the elections? What was the word on the street?
I don't know. I didn't go
yeah.
this year. I mean, I've been most years. The last 10 years, I've been more often than not. And this, I didn't go.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard that a lot of artists didn't go.
Mm-hmm.
I heard that, and I heard that at least one collector mentioned that it was a lot less fun this year because the artists didn't show up.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Mm. I don't know. I mean, I feel like I feel like you can't trust the sales reports. I feel like the sales reports in the press were positive, but I never trust that. I have no idea how it really was.
Yeah.
But it seems like, from what I can tell, business happened.
Yeah.
But it was less, like maybe Miami's peaked. I don't know. Like it was less of an event. And I'm sure it was still a big event, but
sure,
maybe a little bit less.
Yeah, that sounds right. And my suspicion from the way, way outside, but, you know, from a couple of conversations at least, is that the big galleries at Basel itself, Miami Basel itself, did fine. And then, you know, once you get to the satellite fairs, you're talking about a hit or miss type of situation.
Right, which I think is always true. I know the galleries feel like they have to do the fairs, but I think it seems like it's a real roll of the dice whether they're going to make their, you know, they come in owing a bunch of money.
Yeah.
You know, you come in and you spend a bunch of money on a booth, and then you spend the whole week trying to earn it back and more, you know.
Do you remember how much your booth was when you were there at Untitled?
It was $5,000.
Okay.
Which is about the cheapest you can do,
I think.
And it was like, yeah, it was like we were in a like smaller sort of like artist run or nonprofit section.
Right. And how did you do?
And we broke even, which people say is really great for a young gallery.
Yeah.
But we worked 10 days straight to break even. Like we didn't earn any money for the 10 days straight that we worked.
So if you count your time as money, you were in the red. In that sense. Yeah.
So we broke even in the sense that we paid for the booth, we paid for our airfare, we paid for our lodging. Like, we didn't lose money, like, overall.
Right.
But, in fact, I think we did a piece about it, actually. Jen and I did a drawing, full disclosure, like, our whole, like, sort of, these are all the things that, all of the behind the curtain of Miami.
Luxury living. Luxury living the dream?
Oh, yeah, totally. Living the dream.
Yeah. Okay.
And I think we worked out that we might have come out slightly in the black, like not counting for time, but then that maybe we earned like 12 cents an hour or something if you put our time on it.
Right. Beautiful. Well, I was trying to figure out how to make a nice segue, I guess, if nothing else, just talking about the art world vis-a-vis the art fair, you know, and sort of the art universe, even if it's a trade show, kind of comes together in a sense, because you made these two paintings with lines that I just think are so important. They are so important to me anyway. And they're paradox paintings. One of them is paradox painting the system. And it's like a wrapping paper
A
candy with a wrapping paper. Is that what you would call it?
Right. Wrapped candy.
Yeah. And it says, so the paradox painting, the system, says, I want to overturn the system, but also succeed in it. And then the other one, paradox painting elitism, is I hate elitism, but I distrust mainstream tastes. And that latter one, I think, is even more sort of, I mean, they're both poignant, but even more perhaps the latter, just because I think elitism is such an interesting word. I feel like an elitist in a lot of cases, because like when people are talking about popular culture, I often want to hold up my nose because I think people have such bad taste, you know? And of course, what's his name? From the Times, the film... A.O. Scott wrote a piece about elitism, which you may remember. But in any case,
I don't know it. No.
Yeah. It was about elitism in film, and it came out of he wrote something mean or you know sort of dismissive about a crappy blockbuster that Samuel L. Jackson was in, and Samuel L. Jackson sort of laid into him on Twitter or something like that. So that inspired the article. But in any case, I'm not sure if I have a question here other than what are your thoughts on elitism and mainstream and that whole dynamic?
Well, I was just looking at, you know, I called up an image of the piece, too, to look at it while you were talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just thinking that I wonder if it would have been more accurate to say I want to hate elitism.
Right.
I guess actually there's... Although, on the other hand, you can be an elite and hate elitism.
Right.
Like the idea that only certain classes of people can have opinions about things that are valid or whatever. And I, even though, you know, I feel like we are, people like us are very educated in our particular world and you want to say an elite, we're an experts in the field or whatever. But the ism sort of mean is like an exclusion, only educated people have good opinions. And I don't, I resist that still.
Yeah.
And I think of like my husband who, I've said, like, this is like a marker of, you know, when we met, when my husband and I met, he had never heard of Cindy Sherman.
Right.
And that just made me feel, realize how tiny the art world is. Like, really,
right.
Like, but when he looks at art with me, he, and he doesn't trust his own eyes because he's not trained in art at all.
Yeah.
But he always has really interesting responses. And, like, you know, that's true of many, many people who don't have an art education. If
yeah.
they'll just, like, allow themselves to say
yeah.
something. Everyone's so intimidated.
Yeah.
But, so.
I feel the same way about my girlfriend, by the way.
Not like elitism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. She has really insightful opinions, and she doesn't come from an art background either.
Right. And I think elitism, like the ism of it, would discount people like that's opinion.
Right.
You know, and that's where I don't want to go.
Right. Meanwhile, and I'm fortunately I thought of this as you were talking about that, a much more complicated and tricky dynamic in elitism or yeah, elitism with the ism is within the art world itself. And what I mean by that is you and I can both be in the middle on either sort of in between being excluded and being the excluders. And what I mean by
yeah.
that is, you know, there are people, there are circles or people or what have you that we want to get break into, you know, in some way, even if
right.
it's just for
there
a moment.
Hierarchies.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right. And then there are people who are trying to get access to us or our approval
yep.
or what have you. And that we're
yeah.
rejecting. So that form of elitism is really tricky because it's like you get rejected and you don't want to impart that onto others, but inevitably you have to.
Well, nobody has to be a jerk.
True.
You know, like you, there has to be room to not give everyone what, not like give everyone everything that they ever wanted and you have nothing, you know, you have no time left because you say yes to everyone.
Yeah.
And you can, like, there's room between that and being a jerk.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
Right. Well, speaking.
Like, I think if.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
I was just going to say, well, let's take your experiences at your openings because I think that's a really good barometer or, you know, or example. You have an opening of your show, right? And you have your friends there. And then you have people who maybe are fans of your work or what have you, people who maybe are encountering it for the first time and they really want to engage you and have maybe longer conversations than you would like or have time for. You know, how do you... Yeah, obviously, I presume you know how to handle those situations, but how do you handle them?
Oh, I'm always, I mean, if somebody, it does, it's not like it happens to me all the time. Like, if somebody knows my work and wants to talk to me, I am super thrilled.
Right.
I'm, like, psyched and happy to talk to them.
Right.
I mean, at openings are always, like, everyone's, like, pulling you a million directions.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I'm not trying to extricate myself from that person. I'm like super happy,
right.
you know, but I think one thing that I think of when you were positing the question though, is that that hits home is the situation of actually being a gallerist with my friend Jen with Auxiliary Projects and having people, you know, invite us for studio visits and want to do shows with us and stuff. And we can't say yes to all of them. And that is a hard situation, you know. I don't like being in that position. After so many years of being in that other position,
yeah,
it is hard to be in the position of telling people that we can't work with them, you
yeah.
know, because you can't work with everyone or it's not always a good fit or whatever.
Right. Are there any takeaways that come to mind, you know, sort of in the bigger sense?
Huh. I mean, you know, it's been, in a lot of ways, it's been an interesting experience to be on the gallery side. And, I mean, we've noticed a gender divide in terms of how many people invite us to do studio visits or,
mm-hmm.
You know, respond when we say we would like to do a show. And, you know, for a long time I've been looking at sexism in the art world or actually... more more precisely gender disparity in the art world.
Right.
And some of it's due to sexism, and some of it, I'm really feeling from my auxiliary projects experience that some of it's due to a confidence gap. That men really are, I mean, they're a small sample size of a few dozen or whatever. The men are really more ready to go, like are more assertive and in like promoting themselves. And I don't mean that it can be a bad thing. It can be too aggressive or whatever, but I don't mean it in a bad way. I mean, like, I don't mean that the men shouldn't be doing it. I think the women should be doing it.
Yeah. How much from doing your studio visits, how much would you say confidence ultimately makes the sale for you? In other words, if you had two identical studio visits and in one the artist was, you know, a better talker / more confident about what they were doing, but the work was identical, you know, would you inevitably be swayed more by the confidence?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like to think that, because I'm so contrary, I like to think actually I'd actually be more inclined to the other person.
Right.
But it's hard to know without being in that situation. But one thing that I do know is that we've actually said to people, you know, let's do a show. Like, we have a slot. It's like 2 months away. Can you do it?
Yeah.
And there's a real gender divide there. Like, the men would tend to be game for, you know, like, totally, I could be ready tomorrow. And the women seem to think, oh, I'm going to need at least a 6-month lead time. Like, I'm not ready. There's a
right.
lot, like, it's definitely more common for the women to say they're not ready.
Right.
So in a situation like that, mm-hmm. if you're not careful, the men do get more shows.
Yeah.
Just because they're jumping for them,
right.
you know?
Right, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I don't, that's interesting. But I also am curious just about the confidence, you know, gender regardless. Because, and I'm glad you're contrarian, but, you know, from conversations I've had with people about studio visits and my own role in them, I feel like I would be best served by putting on the best show possible. But maybe that needs to be really tailored, and maybe you need to sort of know either in the moment or ahead of time, ideally, you know, who that person is and whether you should put on the show for them or not, if you know what I mean.
Right. It's hard. It's funny because one time we at Auxiliary Projects offered an artist a show, a guy artist,
mm-hmm.
and he wrote back like really enthusiastically and said, I will kill it. And Jen and I were like, I mean, we love this guy. I'm not going to tell you who he is, but we love this guy and
right.
we love his work.
Right.
But we were like, whoa.
Yeah.
And then I said that to, so then I asked Ed Winkleman, who I've worked with for many years,
mm-hmm.
My gallerist, my former gallerist, because now he doesn't have a gallery.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But we're still very close. He's great.
Mm-hmm.
I asked him, I was like, is that a good thing? Would you be psyched to hear an artist say, I will kill it?
Yeah.
And he was like, fuck yeah, I would. He's like, that is just someone who's like going to go to the mat. They're going to do all the things. They're confident. And they're like in it. And I was like, wow, like, okay.
You were swayed. Like, were you swayed by that?
Yeah. I mean, I was already charmed by it, but it just like surprised me when, you know, like initially, but I thought it was, I just thought like, that is something I would never say. But I'm going to need to learn how to say it.
Okay, well...
I will kill it.
Well, being the contrarian you are, you will appreciate this because, as you know, I have a moratorium on the P word on this show, you know.
Which is so funny because I like the P word.
Okay, well, thank you for not saying it and not having the need to. But, I mean, that kill it. That's that whole vocabulary that needs to be killed in the literal sense, not in the figurative one, because you know where that kind of lame language comes from. It comes from sales. It comes from like real estate sales. First of all, it comes from comedy, right? From comedians killing the room,
right,
or
killing
it.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. But then that got filtered down into mid-level marketing and, you know, and real estate and sales. And now artists and gallerists are saying it. You know,
uh-huh.
I went to a studio visit. So-and-so's killing it.
Fuck
that. That's fucking lame, okay? I'm happy that this guy was confident, but that kind of language needs to die right now.
That is so funny.
Not like, ha-ha funny, a, but...
It's, no, no, well, it's interesting. It is also kind of funny.
Right.
But it's funny in both ways. But I think that I don't associate it with the art world, and that's why it felt so out of context to me, and that's why it was like...
Aren't you on social media, Jen?
Yeah, but I never...
You don't see that on Instagram? I've seen it.
No.
I've seen it tons of times on Instagram. So and so's killing it.
Who do you follow? I mean, I need to
stop following
names,
these
but
people.
I mean, like galleries, I guess.
No, yeah, galleries, artists, both. Both did studio visits, and they say so and so is killing it in the studio.
All right, I'm going to watch out for it now.
Yeah. Okay. You'll get back to me once your eyes are opened. Yeah.
I'm sure they will. Like, you know, when someone points something out and you're like, I don't see that. And
right.
Then you see it everywhere.
Exactly. Okay. I can't wait till you see it everywhere because I want you to know what it feels like. Want you to suffer.
That's so funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure you probably don't want to spend your time this way, but I'm dying to know why you hate the P word so much. Like, I know some people don't like it. I mean, it doesn't seem like a big deal to me.
Well, I think...
And I think it's useful.
I think it can be useful, but it's been... Well, you know, I have a... I'm going to admit up front that... And we're talking about this because you haven't used it, so I appreciate that. I want to show my gratitude. I think the way that I just first heard it, it just had a really tinny sound to me. And this is why. It just sounds really pretentious, you know? It's like... In my practice, you know, I do this, this, and this, as if it's so fucking important, you know? Mm-hmm. I am not a doctor. I am an artist. And in my practice, this is what I do. This is what I accomplish. You know what I mean? This is how I am changing the world in my practice. Do you see what I'm saying? I can see how, you know, the daily practice, you know, meditation, art, drawing, you know, et cetera. I get the use of that word in that context as opposed to work. Sort of flows.
I'll tell you why I like it.
Okay, go ahead.
And it comes from the meditation or the yoga or whatever, although I'm not a big yoga person. Mm-hmm. But what I like about it is the aspirational.
Right.
Because I'm not there yet. I'm practicing.
Right.
Like,
right.
I like that it acknowledges that you never get there.
Yeah.
That you're like, it's about trying to get there.
Right.
That's what I like about it.
I like that too. But, you know, in the world that we live in, you know, you wouldn't have the career you have if you hadn't already got there to a certain extent. You know what I mean? You are definitely practicing in your work that you're making. You are practicing in the aspirational sense. But Charlie James doesn't want to hear you, you know, practicing. He wants to hear you've made
it.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's the paradox.
Right. But I guess I'm not just thinking, I'm actually, when I think of practice, I'm not thinking of career. I'm thinking of the artwork. And you know how I feel like we all have these ideal, perfect works in our head.
Right.
And then we make them and we don't get there.
Right.
I almost never get, you know, like it's not easy to make a great art.
Right.
So, and it's about the aspiring to make the great art and getting as close as you can.
Yeah. And you and I, and we can talk about that and, you know, and it could be right now and it can be totally fine and legitimate. But when you're in the studio doing a studio visit with somebody, I don't know if most of them want to hear you say that. You know what I mean?
Right, right, right.
Especially if they're a gallerist.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want you to practice. I want you to kill it.
Yeah. I don't want to hear this practice. You're not practicing. You're killing it. Sell to me, baby.
Totally using this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, gosh, I kind of feel like we can't end there because ending on this word that I've banned feels a little, I don't know what the word is. It feels very queer, very strange. Well, let's let you plug your show then. When is your show?
My show opens February 25th at Charlie James.
Okay.
And I'm actually still hammering out, I'm still practicing Sorry, actually, that was probably pushing it.
Right.
on the title, actually, right now its working title is An Order to the Body, which
okay.
is part of a quote like from St. Augustine, where it's like you can give an order to the body and it complies, but you can't give an order to the mind.
Wow. That's like fascinating.
So it is actually my whole show is kind of about practicing.
Wow.
I'm sorry to say.
Okay.
but you're we'll not, see what you think.
But you'll only use it in the press release once, right? No more than once.
I actually don't know that I'm going to use it. I might use it in the literal sense because there is a piece in my show where I try to learn how to do a standing backflip, and I'm quite literally practicing. But other than that, I won't use it. I won't use it in a metaphoric sense at all.
I love that I saw that, by the way, online, the backflip piece. And I love that you properly use the word practicing in that piece, because that is definitely practicing. Jen, it's been great talking. Thank you so much.
Great talking to you. Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. And before we get to the bonus footage, we are out. Thank you so much again to Jen Dalton. It was so great to talk to her. And as far as her show, it is actually going to be called Participation Trophy. And that opens again at Charlie James, February 25th. If you are in LA, come by to that. Jen and I did speak quite a bit longer about some of our mutually crossing over paths at UCLA. Might turn that into a bonus episode. Might not. Not sure. But, yeah, just know that we had some paths in common. However, we didn't know each other. So that's what that was about. Again, thank you very much in advance for your support of the show. If you are not able to contribute financially, you can certainly support the show by following the show on social media at Artist Podcast on Instagram, Twitter, and you can follow on Facebook as well. You can also leave a great review on iTunes, which is linked through theconversationpod.com. Which, if enough people do it, will help other people find this show, which is, of course, always very important to growth. And, yeah, it's been a long episode. I hope you enjoyed that. And if you're listening to this on Martin Luther King Day weekend, I hope you're having a good weekend. And Godspeed over the next week. Let's see where things go. I think we're mounting our forces and people are getting active. So let's just leave it at that for now. I know you don't come here for preaching or uprising, but just, you know, want to let you know that I'm thinking about things too. I look forward to talking to you next week. Have a good one, and I will talk to you then. Ciao for now.